I'm Vernon Trollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Brian Walensky, OD, FAAO, owner of Glasses On First in New York City. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in, born in Brooklyn, and then moved out to Long Island at the age of 5, and grew up in Oceanside, Long Island.
I think your father's an optician?
Yeah, he's an optician.
What did your mother do?
So my mom was a teacher's aide. She's now retired for many, many years in the Oceanside School District in Long Island, specifically for kindergarten. Me and my father are in business together and in optical, and my mother takes care of the money.
Well, speaking of what you're doing, why private practice and not industry or academia?
Well, I've done a lot of different things. Initially, when I first started, I worked at a Pearle Vision Center. So in the industry, as far as being corporate optometry, then I actually got very bored with that and then went and did a residency. So I took a year to work in corporate optometry, then went and furthered my education to incorporate a residency, which I found very, very helpful. And at the time, I really did want to pursue academia. And kind of in a way, I was upset that I didn't go that track initially, but now I'm actually more thankful for it because I think I did need to put some years under my belt before considering that. And it's something I would like to actually continue to maybe pursue and considering. I actually came back to New York City after my residency in Florida at Nova Southeastern and then came in with my father into the optical.
Well, I was going to ask you, why did you follow your father into being an optician?
So, well, what I was thinking, my father being someone who, one, immigrated to this country at 16 years old, then he, just a little background of him, he then at 18, 19 years old joined the Marines, wasn't even a citizen of the United States, and went to Vietnam and served our country.
So where did he immigrate from?
From Israel. My grandparents wanted to get away from troubles, from war. That's all they lived their whole lives. And they said they were coming to the United States, so where my aunt was already living. So my father went into the military, went into the Marines, was in Vietnam. And then when he returned, really didn't know what he was going to do. So a friend of his was an optometrist, actually a friend from Israel who also immigrated to the United States. And from there, he got interested in opticianry, and part of from being in the military paid for him to go to school to become an optician. And then my father was in Albany taking his opticianry exam and practical to get his licensing on the day I was born. Yeah, I was 2 weeks late, and he was up in Albany taking his test. And as he always says, he was the last one to know that I was born.
What has it been like working with family then?
It has its ups and downs. It's difficult. I mean, my father, you know, being an optician in the 1970s, 1980s, in the heyday of no insurance and lots of cash paying patients and, you know, clients, very different way that optometry and even opticianry is practiced now. So when I finished New England College of Optometry in 2000, then did my residency from 2001 to 2002 and came here back to New York City, you know, I wanted to incorporate a lot of different things that he wasn't used to. So it was definitely a big challenge for both of us to see eye to eye on. When I started dilating patients, he said, "What are you doing that for?" He didn't understand it. I said, "Just give him a prescription for glasses." I said, "No, Dad, this is a new era, and we have to move forward, and we have to take care of our patients in a different way, in a better way." He definitely finally came around and saw my way. But we do. What's great about it is that we can sit and talk business. We can have our differences. We can have our arguments. But at the end of the day, we're family, and we love each other and care about each other, and it's all about us taking care of ourselves.
You're in New York City. How does your practice successfully compete in New York City?
So one thankful thing I am thankful for is that we are sort of a community, a staple in the community. The practice has been here for I mean, since we've had a presence here in New York City, in the specifically the Upper East Side, since the 1980s. This particular place that we're in now, we've been here since 1992. So the community knows us. We don't even advertise. I have down the block from me, you know, a Cohen's Optical. I have Lens Crafters. I have other private practitioners. There's Warby Parker that opened up down the block. And really, I think what shows is that we've just been here throughout the years. People know us. They trust us. We're here to make a living and be part of the community as well.
Well, that's something that a lot of private practice optometrists, you know, really, really agonize through.
Sure, and I think that's a huge thing. Service is one and trust is another. And I think that stuff is more important. And also, you know, treating people as I feel you want to be treated. So when I work with my patients, I think of them as, if this was my family, what would I do? You know, who would I refer this person to if they needed further care? Or what kind of care do I want to offer this person? So that's the way I kind of come across.
What do you do for downtime?
So I work a lot, but in my downtime, I like music, going to concerts. I see a guitar in your background there.
I have several, yes.
Several, so I dabble in guitar, but right now I'm trying to teach myself piano. I found my neighbors didn't like the noise, so now I'm able to just plug in an 88 keyboard and with headphones on, and I don't annoy the neighbors. So trying to learn. My colleagues don't know about me is that I was very heavily involved growing up in theater and music, and I did go to band camp as a kid.
So you were in high school theater?
Yeah. High school, college, and then I had to go into something that's going to actually give me a career. My only acting gig was a paid acting gig. I was an extra in Howard Stern's Private Parts.
Oh, wow. Oh, boy.
That was the summer right before I started optometry school.
Huh. Marvelous. Why low vision?
So I actually found low vision by accident. Sort of a journey for me that I found low vision. And something I didn't really know that I liked, or really I knew it existed, but didn't really know how to practice it. So in around 2009, 2010, I was, you know, here working in New York City at Glasses on First with my father, with another partner of his, there's a third partner, another optician. And, you know, I was working retail optometry, giving the best care I could give in a retail optometry setting in New York City, where everyone wants everything yesterday and five minutes ago is too late. So it's a difficult patient population because everyone's stressed and everyone's in a hurry to get nowhere, as I say. So around 2009, 2010, I really wasn't happy where I was personally and professionally. I never imagined staying in New York City. I kind of like the countryside. I like having a yard. I like having my car. And those things really don't exist here. So I actually sat down with my father and I actually said, I think I have to find something else to do. And I knew it wasn't going to be, I didn't think it was going to be an optometry, actually. I said, I think I'm going to just try to find a whole new career. So I researched what I was going to do. And I said, maybe I liked academia. I remember really enjoying my time at Nova Southeastern when I was a resident. And I loved interacting with the students and teaching. I always liked Florida because I liked the weather. And I still had my optometry Florida license. I said, let me go down to Florida and let me get a teacher's license to teach high school biology. So I went all the way down to Key West and met with faculty at Key West Community College and said, okay, I'm here. I'm going to want my teacher's license to teach biology because my degree in undergrad was biology. So when I got down there, they informed me, well, you have to be a year resident down here before we can have the schooling for free, or else you have to pay this much money. And I said, well, that's not worth it, so let me do the year residency and stay for a year. But of course, I needed a job. I just couldn't hang out in Key West. So I went up to Fort Lauderdale area. I have some friends and family in that area. and found myself living in Hollywood, all right by the beach, which was wonderful. And I was really looking for other opportunities. Like I was able to get side jobs at Sears Optical, at a Pearle Vision. I was able to, work here and there at different places, but I really didn't, it's not something I wanted for my future. Is just to be in a retail optometry practice. So I just did some research, and about 2 months in, I found an ad for that the Miami Lighthouse for the Blind was looking for an optometrist, a consulting optometrist. I didn't know what in the world they were looking for, and I just called them up, and they said, "Great, come on over for an interview." And that is really what I say has changed the course of my career, has changed the course of me getting involved in low vision and has molded me to what I'm doing today. So I met this woman there, a very remarkable woman named Virginia Jacko. Now she's the CEO of the Miami Lighthouse. She herself is blind from retinitis pigmentosa. And she was just very, 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 very remarkable and very convincing woman. So she asked me, "What do you know about children's vision exams?" And I said, "Well, nothing. I'm afraid to see a kid under 10 years old. I only saw 10 and up because I never really was involved in binocular vision and pediatrics." And she said, "Well, we want you here," and it was very strange, "not to really do children's exams, and it's not low vision exams. We have a children's vision program called the Florida Hyken Children's Vision Program, which has been in existence since the 90s. And we need a consulting optometrist to do quality control, to come in once a week, review our records, make sure we're on the up and up, because we do exams for all the students who don't have any health insurance or are on what's called the school lunch program, a type in schools. We do comprehensive eye exams in the schools of all Miami-Dade, of any child that is in need of eye care who can't afford it. And they provided the glasses. So they have this mobile unit that goes to all the schools, go in there, see like 30 to 50 kids, full comprehensive exams. We're not just doing screenings, and we're dilating them at the school, and they're getting glasses if they need it through a fund. That was actually set up by, it's MDOPA. I'm trying to remember. It's a Miami-Dade Optometric Association, where it originally started from. And then it was taken over by Miami Lighthouse, who facilitates it and has all the vehicles and able to do everything. So I said, "This sounds great. I come in, I do paperwork once a week, and it's something different. Let me find out what else I could do." So about did that for about 2, 3 months, and next thing I know, Virginia calls me into her office again. She goes, "Brian, guess what?" I said, "What?" "We just got the contract for the whole entire state of Florida, and we want you to be the interim manager to take care of the whole state. We're sending you up to Tallahassee. You're going to go pick up a check that the Department of Health is funding us. We want you to go meet all the legislators. We want you to go meet all the people involved. We want you to meet with the Department of Health, the Department of Education. We need you to go to every single county that and make contracts with each county that we want to come in and see kids who are financially underprivileged to give all their eye care, comprehensive exams, and figure out how we're going to get them the glasses." So now this little job one day a week turned into me traveling the whole entire state setting up something. So what was funny about that is that I never really used Excel before. So now I'm finding myself, I have to use Excel, I have to do this, I'm learning all new things I never did before. A lot of things I do, I've learned on the job. I've all learned lots of things while I was doing it. So more practical rather than from a book. So next thing I know, a couple of months in, we're doing the program. It was pretty much set up as a voucher program. She calls me into her office again. "Virginia, what do you want this time?" "Well, Brian, our numbers are a little low. We need to get out there. We need to go to the schools. The voucher program, the parent, and that's a known thing where parents are not going to be bringing their children. They think it's not free, or they think their child doesn't have a problem. So we have to get there and go to the schools. So I got into one of their mobile units with one of the technicians. And again, we traveled the whole state. And now I find myself seeing pre-K and kindergarten and first and third graders and learning on the job of how to do mobile portable eye care for children. And I spent the next year and a half doing that around the whole entire state. It was fascinating. It was a great
Yeah.
time, so I really got something different.
Yeah, you went down there to be a biology teacher, and you really, which you, and then you stepped into this.
And
Wow.
not only that, then I started going to school meetings, talking with parents about the importance of eye care, running a continuing education program with the Florida State Nurses Association and teaching them about, just eye care and what's going on, and going to in-service meetings for all the different counties so the school nurses understood what we were coming in and doing, teaching people how to do efficient screenings and what we were doing to kids. So now I became this sort of expert where something I never did before. And so then Virginia, about after a year and a half, calls me in her office again. And she goes, "Brian, what do you know about low vision? Our low vision optometrist is leaving us, and we'd like you to take on that role. The program, the Florida Hyken Children's Vision Program, is running now. We've got it off the ground, and we have more doctors working in the program, and we really need can use you here." So I said, "Well, I learned some low vision when I was in residency at Nova. I did some low vision at New England Optometry, but that's really the last time I've done anything with it." She goes, "Well, we're going to send you up to Chicago with a guy named Dr. Tracy Williams, and he's going to give you a crash course, and you're going to spend some time with him to learn low vision." And that's what I did. I opened up my old textbooks, I looked online, I learned as much as I could, and then I got on the job training with amazing low vision doctor, Dr. Williams, and I learned so much from him. Next thing I know, I come back to Florida and I'm the low vision optometrist for Miami Lighthouse. And the other challenge to that was it's a very large Spanish speaking population. And unfortunately, I really didn't know much Spanish, but I learned quickly on how to do low vision exams and eye exams in Spanish. So it was another challenge. And that's how I found low vision. And really, the people at the Miami Lighthouse have become like family to me. They're such wonderful people. Another director of programs there, Carol Brady Simmons, has really taught me a lot, and so many other people down there have taught me a lot. So I still maintain a relationship with them. About a year and a half into, doing low vision there, my father calls me in New York City. "We need some help. We need you to come back to New York. We need help in the practice. People are asking for you. They want to see you again. Otherwise they're going elsewhere." So, because I had a relationship with a lot of my patients for so many years. So I said, "Well, I'll come back on one condition, that I want to incorporate low vision into our practice, because it's something I found that I love, and I found sort of a more of a purpose towards doing things rather than just saying, 'Give me my contacts or glasses.'" So I was really helping individuals. And a lot of the, and I like to say now, even a lot of the patients I see in low vision not only become like my patient, but some of them have become friends because I learn every day from them in low vision. That's what I like about practicing low vision.
So why are children's vision programs important, and what keeps you engaged?
Well, as we all know, the statistics as optometrists, 1 in 4 children need glasses. 80% of learning is visual. And students, I believe, if I remember the number, it's up to 40% of children who are placed in special needs programs or act out behaviorally actually just need some vision correction or some vision therapy. It's actually not an issue of learning. It's just that they need correction and the right care. So that's why I find that it's so important that we stay engaged with that. And it's also taught me a lot of how to stay engaged with the community. So when I came back to New York, I started doing vision screenings with some of the pre-K programs here in New York City. I tried starting a program with the Department of Education here in New York City. It didn't go as planned. And currently now, I'm trying to work with Caring for the Homeless for their family homeless shelters for children to get care, because I believe the situation that a child is in is not their fault. They're just born into it. If we can give them sort of a chance or a step forward with clear vision, they can make their way. So it's just something I became passionate about and I didn't know existed. Exactly, I just opened my eyes to things. Same with low vision.
How are wearable technologies benefiting low vision patients now, and what about their future?
Well, what's great is that wearable technology is existing, or even all technology, from our cell phones. I mean, any low vision patient that comes in and sees me, the first thing I ask them is, are you using a smartphone? I think low vision and blind patients should, that's their main tool. That's the basically thing they should be using. As far as wearables, the whole concept of wearables is just that it's something that's hands-free. It's something that, you know, we're all using wearable technology to keep hands-free, such as our Bluetooth devices, our headphones. You know, it just makes sense that wearables will be in the low vision area. The future of it, it's getting better and better. I even see it from a company that I consult for. So I consult for OrCam Technologies, which is out of Israel. I met them right while I was doing low vision in Florida, and then got more involved with them when I came up to New York. They were just launching their device here in the United States, and now they're pretty much all over the world. But when their first device came out, they were looking for guidance. How do we create a user guide? How do we do our training program? How do we enter the low vision market? How do we talk with ophthalmologists and optometrists? We want to start studies. So again, another area I got involved in that I got learned as I went, an opportunity that came my way. And it's been great working in this area, because just seeing people using technology and gaining more independence or just increasing quality of life has been a wonderful part of what I've been a part of, that I can change somebody's life and use a piece of technology. Where is it going in the future? Like I said, I think all of these technologies like OrCam or some of the others out there are just gonna get better and better. Even OrCam, 2 days ago, they released their OrCam 2.0, their second generation of their device, right here in New York City. And CBS News was there, Telemundo was there, because the device now speaks in multiple languages, so of course in Spanish, and it was aired in 20 different countries. So it's growing, it's getting better, and I think as optometrists, we're gonna be able to access that technology for a lot of our patients and really make a difference in their lives.
Is their new device smaller than the first one?
It's smaller, lighter, and wireless. More functionality.
What's something you would change about optometry as it stands now?
Wow, that's a loaded question. That's a lot of things. A lot of things. I mean, I think we're moving in the right direction. We're doing more medical care. The thing I would change is we need to really teach young students not only about medical care, but how to survive and bill for this stuff and how to get paid for it. It's something I'm trying to learn on my own, and I find that harder than all the other stuff that I've learned on my own. I think that's what we really need to change. But I think we're moving in the right direction. But I also think we can't forget our past. I didn't like when some of the schools took out like some of the opticianry stuff, learning how to, you know, make glasses doing the finishing lab stuff and creating and making a pair of eyeglasses. I don't think we need to focus so much on it, but I think it's important that we don't forget our past so we can move forward. You know, a lot of things are changing when we're having to accommodate and we're having to change, such as the things online, you know, contact lenses, online refractions, online, or what they're calling eye exams. We're having to change because all of these things exist and are getting more popular. And unfortunately, I don't know how we're going to stop it. You know, for the benefit, we really have to concentrate on the benefits of our patients, which I think we all are doing.
Is it a matter of stopping it or adapting to it?
That's the word I've been looking for, is more adapting. sorry, more adapting. I think that's why it's so important we move forward with medical care. But how do we do that at the same time with our patients understanding that just by getting something online of a vision test is not an eye exam, and this concerns me that people are going to get confused of the two, and things are going to be missed.
Now for something frivolous, what's your guilty pleasure food?
Guilty pleasure food. My problem is I don't eat all day. I get so busy. I work too much, but I enjoy the work I do.
But you know, you're in New York City, so you have that whole palate, and you've been to Florida.
Yeah.
You know, so
I'm not a sweets person. I'm more a savory. So I eat whatever's put in front of me too. But love sushi. I was out last night to Indian food. I love steak, and I eat everything. So there's no real, I guess, guilty pleasure. Is just all the bad foods we eat, pizza, all the stuff that raises my cholesterol and is bad for my heart, I guess.
Okay. Do you have any regrets?
I mean, there's regrets in a lot of different things. You know, I regret not understanding while I was in school, I think, of understanding the whole scope of optometry, of what's available out there. I grew up, you know, in an opticianry family where, you know, they taught me a lot. They definitely tried to steer me in the right directions. But I saw optometry really as this, you know, retail kind of giant thing that's out there. And it took me a long time to find my way. So I guess the regret is not understanding really what was out there myself personally, or maybe not listen. I was so busy studying so hard and trying to do well that I didn't open my eyes to what other opportunities were there. But it did come to me later. So if anything, it's got to be that. I don't know if that's bad or good or... But, you know, just more understanding, I guess, what I know now. I guess a lot of older people who get older say that. Understanding more what I know now versus what I knew when I was younger. It's sort of, now I understood that I needed that, now 17 years practicing, that I needed that 17 years to get where I am today to understand myself better and my profession better.
Mm-hmm. Okay, our last question. We inflict this one on everybody.
Oh.
What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
So getting involved in low vision. So getting involved also even with the wearable technology company, Orcam. So I've had opportunities in low vision. I speak on the subject. I go to conferences. So I had a chance to travel a little bit internationally. And last year I was in Chile. So I was in Santiago, Chile, at a low vision conference. It was done by a group called Fundalerp. Fundalerp is a retinitis pigmentosa group. They invited me down there. I spoke about low vision and represented Orcam as well down there in Chile. And the next day they told me they have an event coming up called Blind Driving. So I said, what in the world is blind driving? You'll see when you get there. They tried explaining it. I didn't really understand what was going on. So we went down to this area of central Santiago. And what they had was a line of cars from the local, like our AAA up here in the United States is their AAA down there of Chile. And they had five cars. And what they were doing was putting individuals who were blind, who never drove before, or if they later on lost their sight and wanted to drive again, they had an instructor sitting in the passenger seat, and they had a blind driver, and they were telling them how to drive. So they were doing that. They were doing everything. They were driving. It was great. The police shut down all the streets, and it was a great event. And then they said, Brian, come on. It's your turn. I said, what do you mean my turn? You know, sighted, I go, no, you're doing this. They put a blindfold on me and had me drive in the streets of Santiago with an instructor who only spoke Spanish. and my broken Spanish or very lack of understanding. But this one woman in the gets in who was part of the Fundalup group says, "Well, I'll come in the car in the back seat. I'll translate for you." But her translation is not good. And I never drove a stick shift car before, a manual.
Oh, wow.
So she keeps telling me, push, punt, hit the punch. What she meant by the punch was the clutch. And I was going slower than the individuals who were there for the event. So it was a very scary event. And I call it crazy because, I don't know, I just never thought of closing my eyes and driving a car and listening to people talk to me in Spanish driving. So it was, but what the exercise did to me, I wanted so bad to take that blindfold off that I kept it on to make sure that I went through the exercise. It made me nervous. It made me scared. It made me, gave me a little anxiety. And it really taught me possibly, it gave me a good lesson of what individuals who are losing their sight are maybe going through. And wanting that independence of losing their driver's license and not driving, or just being able to function and doing daily life activities. So in one way, it was crazy doing that. And in another way, it was a great experience.
To pardon the pun, it was very eye-opening.
Yes.
Brian, that's all the questions I have for you today. Thank you so much for talking with
me. Sure. The other thing I wanted to tell you is just something new that I'm doing. Next month, I'm starting in a practice in a community health center in the Bronx, so a new venture, like I do too many things already. I'm going to be the optometrist at Metro Community Health Centers. It's specifically a center for people with disabilities, so all disabilities. So I'm going to be working in their optometry clinic. So they already have dentistry, psychiatry. They have the regular physicians there for primary care services, and they're adding optometry, and it's going to be my next challenge. Specifically, they work with individuals with cerebral palsy, but it's open to all disabilities.
Wow. You're going to eat even less.
I know.
You're going to have less time to do anything.
Possibly going to be here even less at the retail optometry, which is kind of what I wanted. And my father will call me back again.
Wow, that's cool. Again, Brian, thanks so much for talking with me today.
No, thank you. All right, take care. Bye.